Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 353 of the Roguecast, recorded October 25th, 2021. Don't look into Japan's darkness.
All right, we've all gathered together to podcast once again.
Yes.
And we didn't skip any weeks.
Yeah. Good job, us.
Yeah.
Because it's been a little hectic.
A little bit.
We try to make it as invisible as possible, but right now we're undergoing some, I'm going to call it growing pains behind the scenes. We have a new point-of-sale system.
It's the old point-of-sale system, but basically it was an upgrade.
Right. But you guys know what computers are.
Yeah.
You know what happens.
You know whenever you get a software update, how it's a nightmarish hellscape that makes you want to just set the whole place on fire and take an axe to the computer?
Yep, that's
so
it.
If you happen to come in and you see either an axe being shoved into a computer or me throwing the CPU across the store...
That's what's going on.
Or it's R-rated Rogues Gallery because of language. but it also, it coincides, it's just been a few weeks since Marvel started shipping through their new distributor.
Yep.
A lot of weird growing pains going on behind the scenes. So bear with us. We're trying to do as good as we can, and I think we've mostly made it invisible, it's been a little tough.
Yeah, well, and also everybody knows there's shortages across the board on paper, cardboard, plastic. Fortunately, none of that is used in the manufacture of everything we do.
I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were like, "Oh, you guys had all the stuff I was looking for, and had everything." And I was like, "Yay! Wow! I don't know how, but yay!"
Yeah, there's been Marvel. Some Marvel stuff has been out of print for at least a year. Like, Civil War, Avengers, X Men,
big stories,
big stuff is out of print.
Infinity Gauntlet.
Yeah. Infinity Gauntlet has been out of print for a while.
We probably mentioned this. It is a hope, but we don't know. Just that Marvel, now that they're settled at their new distributor, may kind of put into their trade paperback stuff a little bit more into high gear.
They're slowly but surely getting a couple, but it seems like it may be shortages more than
distributors. Yeah, I was going to say, shortages are definitely hitting. I went, it's my anniversary this year, and I went to go get packages, or I went to go get gift bags,
because
I got a few presents for Kaylee. No gift bags.
Wow.
I went to, Target, and then I went to, didn't have, they were decimated. They had nothing. So
what do you think about using a diamond box and drawing them? Because we've got those.
Yes, we do have those.
Yep. Yeah, so, your wedding came up in my memories. Me and Dave in suits, Londo Jacquard death grip.
That's true.
I don't know if people out there know what the Londo Jacquard death grip is, but all I can say is you should watch Babylon 5.
You should watch Babylon 5.
Well, they'll be given a new death grip in the new series of Babylon 5.
That's true.
And the new one is a slap fight.
We don't even know if they'll be in the new one.
Londo Jacquard slap fight.
But he did say, the way he was describing it was he kind of was planning to envision it the way he would if he were building the series today, but he did also seem to indicate he's like, the stuff that most clearly worked will, have a role and maybe re-envisioned, but, man, I can't imagine those characters won't exist at all.
No, JMS would be like, well, in my original vision, Londo and Jacquard were both hot girls, and it was a jello bikini fight that they had. So it'll be that will be their final destination.
Russell must have seen B5, right?
Russell's definitely seen B5.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Russell, if you're out there, message us and just confirm that for us. And if you could, let us know who your favorite character was.
And just know we're slowly making a list of things you've seen.
Yes. We're actually putting together a very slow profile of you. Honestly, the amount you probably get from taking one internet quiz is like 10 times what we have slowly accumulated over 10 years.
Yeah. But the tortoise and the hare has taught us all lessons in profiling.
That's right.
Some notable D&D stuff came out this week. Fizban's Guide to Dragons.
Yeah, yes. Treasury of Dragons.
Treasury of Dragons.
Get it right.
Sorry. that came out this week.
Really beautiful cover. Yep. And of course, unfortunately, that one, is as has been the case for the last several, is gone.
Yep. Yep.
We were just able to fill our orders once again.
It was close.
Believe me, we order like 80 billion of them, and they're like, here's 24 special covers.
Here's what you get.
And we're like, oh, thank God, that just about fits what we did. Sometimes we have to jump through some hoops and try and do anything we can to get a few extras, and we sometimes can pull it off and sometimes we can't. But I think we did get it for everybody who requested it.
Yes.
And the main book is in. It looks cool. I've only had a chance to flip through it lightly because it just arrived today, but... that's got some hotness in it.
There's also the Dragon Prince board game.
Oh yeah, it's all dragony themed.
Yeah, from the people who do Boss Monster and Cold Adventure.
In the event that you haven't seen Dragon Prince, it's from the same people who did Last Airbender and Korra and stuff like that. And it is a really good fantasy series on Netflix.
There was a few things. So Great Western Trail, which is a beloved board game, got a second edition. Bees, a fun bee-themed game that's been out of print for months,
nice.
Came back in. There is Star Trek Flux has two Enterprise-themed expansions, one for Archer, one for the dog Porthos.
Oh, that's cool.
There is a Dune board game called House Secrets that is based on the game Detective.
Oh, right.
Where you're like, so you're like investigators in the world of Dune. It sounds very cool.
A story-driven game where you are like, investigators for House Atreides or something like that. That actually sounds pretty cool. There's another one that I think hasn't hit yet that's going to be a co-op game.
Yeah.
Or is that it?
No, I that might also be, but I think there's...
I was under the impression the co-op game was different.
Coming. Yeah.
Yeah. But also, that is cool. Let's play it.
Also, there is a... there was an adorable dinosaur roll and write game where you do Dinosaur Island. And Ticket to Ride did their Susan G. Komen Pink Trains.
Did you say Roll and Write?
Roll and Write.
What is that?
So basically it's like it's kind of like a Yahtzee type game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
And I felt like there was something else, but there's a bunch of stuff that came out this week. Lots of new games. As we head into Christmas, there's lots of stuff releasing.
The lesson here is come peruse the new game section in particular.
Yes.
Because it's extra sexy right now.
Yes. That's the lesson.
Welcome to Sexy Rogues Gallery.
Seems worth mentioning that we played Dave's Dread game.
We did.
On Sunday.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was Halloween, and since I hadn't run a game in like 2 freaking years, I don't know why. It's like as if something kind of came up.
Yeah.
But... that said, you know, we snuck in a little bit of Zoom gaming over time, and a lot of people have found ways to do Zoom game, but this is the first in-person game I'd run, and it was a lot of fun. We did a little staff gaming thing. For those who don't recall or haven't seen it, among our indie games is the game Dread. It's a game that uses a Jenga tower for everything. Like, yep. You're not going to be crunching dice numbers or stats or anything on this. There are no stats. You kind of ask who you kind of have normal people characters usually, and it's like a horror movie.
Yeah.
It's meant to be a one night thing. In short, everybody pulls bricks when they got to do stuff. More bricks if it's a harder thing. When the tower collapses, some fate befalls them. The game has it, I think, usually that it's fatal, but I found I kind of like to vary it up a little bit by context.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if somebody's researching in a library. They don't just insta-die. Although, you know, like, depending on the kind of game, if it's some Freddy Krueger dude or something like that, it could.
Nick's character died while he was reading a thing.
It's true.
It was during climactic scenes.
I know, but he was just reading, Dave.
In a school that you knew was dangerous.
Yes, that's true. Schools are dangerous.
Our theme this time was... this is actually the second one I've done in school. One had students. This one, you were playing a combination of parents, teachers, custodial staff, and a visiting writer who died horribly.
It's true. Yes, he did.
Nick, can you tell us what the book was that... or the dinosaur... or the series he wrote?
I think the...
Dinosaur Detectives.
Yeah, Dinosaur Detectives.
Yes, but he was on the downslide of it.
Yes.
One of the fun things about Dread is the character creation in which the GM sends out questionnaires to the players, and they have like in the Dread book, they kind of have suggestions on what kind of questions you should ask. And they're usually sort of leading questions like, why do you carry a gun in your glove compartment? And the person answering it is like, well, I guess I carry a gun in the glove compartment first thing. But then they get to invent some interesting story background stuff for it. And I got, like, kind of basic character concepts from y'all, and then so that y'all could have some agency in it. And then we used the questions to flesh them out. And, y'all ended up with a fascinating cross-section of weird, nobody badass.
No,
you know,
no,
like,
no.
Just normal people. There was, like, a gun or two in the mix, and... honestly, our children's author got a little tough guy. He was out there with a crowbar at times.
Yeah.
And like everybody was like investigating things, strange, spooky happenings at a school, but yes, it did turn violent in the end.
And circumstances gave us a little bit of an extra scare there. We were in the middle of the game. We were playing at the store, and Something had just happened. You were explaining something, and all the power went out of the complex, and so all the lights went out. It was perfect spooky.
And this was like the part of a thematic in the game was the danger of sort of these shadows around the school and stuff like that. There was some sort of otherworldly being that was terrorizing the children. and was specifically lurking in pools of shadows and things. And
something is shadowing the
tree. And suddenly the lights go out.
Yep.
That was very cool. Yeah. So, that was a ton of fun. And I do recommend people pick up Dread. Maybe run it a dozen times or something like that, and I feel like I can offer you solid practical advice on what I do to kind of try and amp the tension, and even a few things I slightly disagree with in how they do their own game, the game. But it's a super easy one, and that requires almost nothing of the usual role playing game stuff. Like, people don't need to build a character and take hours to do it.
Yep.
It's kind of more, it's like that indie game thing where it's leaning a little more into the creative side.
Yeah. It's super fun. It's a Halloween tradition, and I always enjoy it.
Yeah. Y'all had a bunch of good characters, too.
Yeah, it was fun.
Next year, we'll buy one of the giant Jenga towers.
I kind of like it, because, man, when that thing falls, you're going to feel it.
All right, moving on to news. History of the World Part 2 series has been ordered at Hulu. So, History of the World Part 1 is a, 70s or 80s?
I think it might have been, 1980 or 81. Mel Brooks movie.
Mel Brooks' movie, yeah.
That was like a series of vignettes about ancient Earth history, more or less.
Yeah. There's caveman times, but there's also a lot in Roman times.
Yep.
And there's a lot of anachronistic jokes.
Right. It's like him and some of his players and that are some of his regulars.
Madeline Kahn, Gregory Hines. Not Gregory Hines.
Dom DeLuise. Harvey Korman.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sid Caesar. And, doing what Mel Brooks does, which is a combination of crass jokes and sly jokes and physical humor and stuff like that. And
it was narrated by Orson Welles.
Was it?
I think it was.
Crazy.
Yep.
And I believe because this was taking place in the era where big franchises like Star Wars were beginning to happen, they kind of jokingly called it History of the World Part 1, or maybe, just...
But at the end of History of the World Part 1... He does this bit about we're going to see Hitler on ice.
Oh, that's right.
And Jews in space.
Yes.
And all the various. And so I'm wondering if History of the World Part 2, if he's going to pay off some of that stuff.
I mean, you can't not do some of the stuff that was joked about
but
in there.
He's show running it. Mel Brooks is close to
90 something.
He's 90 something.
Yeah.
And I'm a little worried because, man, I don't know if he can do a thing that's not offensive.
Right. It's kind of hard to. And honestly, few people could be considered to be at any sort of able to put out that kind of level of creative output in their 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like around my 40s, I lost it. But Mel Brooks, whatever else, has always seemed like an awesome dude. I definitely hope it comes off.
I'm kind of excited for it. I hope it's good. I want it to be good.
Clearly, we should revisit the original one, cringe a little bit, I'm sure, at some of the jokes, and laugh at the rest, and laugh at the ones we also cringe at.
I don't think Mel Brooks made a bad movie.
I don't know. Have you seen, Silent Movie? I haven't seen all of his stuff. Because he's made some other stuff.
It's kind of like his, I'm going to say, 90s and onward stuff was shakier, right? Spaceballs, is that the last kind of really quite good one?
I think maybe so, but Spaceballs is good.
I do agree.
I mean, Robin Hood Men in Tights was pretty funny.
Oh, I forgot that was him.
Yeah.
Did he do... What else did he do?
Yeah, Robin Hood Men in Tights is actually a solid movie.
I've never seen that one.
The Dracula Dead and Loving It is not great.
Oh,
but
that's not great.
It's got some...
I guess I thought that was a Leslie Nielsen and the Naked Gun guy.
It was, but it's not... It's Leslie Nielsen, but I guess it's not the Naked
Gun. But it was...
No, he stole Leslie Nielsen from them.
Yeah, he did. He stole him.
Well, that makes sense because he kind of invented that style of comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think Robin Hood Men in Tights, Dracula Dead and Loving It, I guess, was the last one in 1995.
Did he go and basically take a 25-year pause?
He looks
retirement.
Yeah. I mean, he's still done some writing on the Spaceballs animated series in 2015.
And I'm sure he's probably done some producing-y stuff,
maybe,
right? Isn't that what you do when you retire?
Yeah.
You produce.
Weird.
Anyway. But anyway, fingers crossed. And for those of you who haven't seen it, go watch History of the World Part 1.
Yep.
Know that you might cringe occasionally at some of the jokes,
yep.
But Mel Brooks, he has a capacity to kind of land jokes that other people might not pull off.
Yeah.
And part of it is a lot can be forgiven if you're funny, and part of it is that he always seemed to be in the spirit of kind of a progressive spirit, but it does mean that he did not, as anybody who's ever seen a cowboy movie,
Blazing Saddles
or anything like that, no, he's not above engaging in racial humor and things like that.
No, not at all.
Or joking about being Jewish or anything like that. Yep. But it does mean that, like, he's a funny guy. He can get away with a lot.
Looks like he's been doing a lot of voice work for the past.
Really?
Yeah, he was in Toy Story 4 as Meliphant Brooks.
Okay.
I guess he was an elephant. One of the.
I don't know.
I forget.
I've seen Toy Story 4. I don't remember it.
But he's done a lot of, like, you know, Hotel Transylvania and.
Huh.
Dora the Explorer?
Interesting.
Okay.
Okay.
What else we got, Ray?
So we've got the trailer for Cowboy Bebop. Not the teaser that was the opening sequence, but a new teaser called The Lost Session.
Yeah, it's kind of like just a glimpse of, like, a moment.
It's basically
it's
like
a very stylish thing, yeah. Like, it's. There is it is in some way all one extended scene, and it has the I don't even know quite what you call it, but like those like little black frames that they use in the opening.
Yeah,
I guess, of that it.
They can sort of move around and sort of change.
Yeah, it's like they are. It's like imagine somebody moving around in a comic and sliding the grid that
it's
they're
the
in.
It's the better
around.
Version of what Ang Lee tried to do in Hulk.
Yeah, or like the kind of what was there. There's definitely a vibe of the Speed Racer movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, catching some of the good stuff on that. I thought it was very entertaining.
I really liked it. I'm very hyped for this now.
I don't have, by the way, I've never seen the original show. I've barely even seen glimpses of it.
Yeah.
So I like didn't have any stake in this, but then I saw that and I was like, oh, that's pretty good. That's a lot of fun.
It felt very in line with the show.
Yeah, I've only
but, like,
seen
did,
a couple
did you
episodes.
Feel like it was somehow bringing its own thing too?
Yes.
Like, with the actors?
Yeah, a little bit, but it was... It had those characters. I mean, they didn't...
It's going to be an original adventure?
Yes.
But they're utilizing a lot of the characters from the show.
Well, they're in that world, but they've said it's new stories, so...
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it. I've only seen a handful of Cowboy Bebop. I haven't seen all of it. But what I've liked, I've liked more than I like most anime... And so this live action thing looks super fun.
The action in it was like really slick and well handled. Like it looks like they did kind of again stylized stuff, maybe just slightly sped up in spots. But that part where he's doing that like big ass jump kick and like I was like that looks freaking cool.
John Cho was the one who played Sulu, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So like he's getting to play some fun nerdy roles, and he got to be a swordsman in that. So
yeah,
he gets to he's only gotten some martial arts training and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's come quite far from his time as Harold and Harold Kumar. Yeah.
As previews go, I think this is about as good as it gets.
Yeah, it was really good.
It kind of sold me on wanting to check it out and check out the original series, probably.
Speaking of the opposite of that, we have the Uncharted trailer.
I won't say it the complete opposite.
I don't know. I thought this was very loud and sort of like it wants to be like this big action-packed, but I just was never invested in it.
Slightly weird use of Led Zeppelin's
Ramble On.
Yeah.
Which is not completely crazy for Uncharted, because
it especially fits Sully. So the biggest, I think, problem, Nick, you and I are big fans of the game. Randy is just, he played like 10 minutes of the game and he was like, boo.
No, it made me sick.
Okay, yeah, that's
like,
right.
Like physically, not literally.
Right, you had motion sickness
so
from the third person.
Yeah, and I also couldn't
do
it.
In that game, you've got basically a guy who looks a lot like slightly younger Nathan Fillion, and then a craggy older dude who, Randy, or Nick, you said somebody like a sort of a Paul Newman type.
Yeah, Paul Newman.
And that is, that's the vibe Sully, his kind of mentor, gives off. And so it cut to the movie, and you have Tom Holland in the role of Nathan Fillion type.
Nathan Drake.
And Mark Wahlberg in what would be the Paul Newman-ish type role. And he definitely felt off.
Yeah, Mark Wahlberg,
I've seen him in good movies.
He's been in good things.
He's fine. I mean, he's, not a great person.
Not a great person.
But also, like, here's the thing. If you're accepting that you're getting older, which clearly Wahlberg had to do this role, go ahead and play it older. Because he's still, it's like his hair is clearly colored. Like, he's playing, he still wants to be like, the hot Mark Wahlberg. I'm like, if you're Sully, I want gray hair, and I want you to be older.
He's now, still in the Transformers.
Right?
Yeah.
I guess they... what was I going to say? Now, even in the games themselves, they did some flashback stuff that showed Nathan Drake when he was younger.
Yeah,
like
Sully
as far as like when he was like, I don't know, 12 or something like that for some sequences where you're like learning to control the game.
So that works for Tom Holland.
Yeah, Tom Holland always looks like he's 12.
Perpetual 12-year-old.
Yep.
I guess he's probably supposed to be like 20...
Yeah, he was like a bartender at some point.
Ish. And Now, once they kind of get the action going, it does kind of look like the game.
Yeah, the
especially
action,
the sequence where they're hanging out the back of a big cargo plane.
Yeah. They definitely were like, "This, we need this to look like the game," but I don't know if that's not as important as telling the story, I think.
Well, even the stories in Uncharted are larger than life, Tomb Raider.
Yeah, they're Raiders of Lost Ark.
They usually have, like, supernatural elements involved. The story fits.
Yeah.
I guess this is retelling how they met, essentially, how the mentor and the basically like the old crotchety treasure hunter and the young up and comer.
I think it's Mark Wahlberg
hunter.
For me. I could take Tom Holland.
Yeah.
I think as a young Nathan Drake,
he could potentially. Yeah.
It's Mark Wahlberg that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
Do you guys think this is going to finally break the streak of terrible video game movies?
No.
No.
But it is possible that it could be solid. Okay. I don't think I would see it in the theater unless I was hearing, like, I need a 70+ on Rotten Tomatoes.
Fair enough.
I'm looking more forward to the Resident Evil movie.
Yeah.
That one did actually finally look like they were kind of doing Resident Evil stuff, but the one thing I wasn't sure about is, are they hitting up the iconic characters? Are you going to do Chris Redfield? Are you going to do Wesker? Are you going to do, what's her name?
I don't know.
I can't
Jill Valentine?
Yeah, Jill Valentine. Because they were in the house, and I saw some iconic scenes in that Resident Evil trailer.
Even the dog, like zombie dog.
Yeah, and I'm like, that's cool, but like, where are the Raccoon City Stars SWAT team people, guys, from that original game? Because that would complete it.
Sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I guess on rewatching this, the second time I'd seen the trailer, and...
It read better.
It read a little bit better. I think maybe it's because I knew there was a cool plane scene coming up at the end.
Is it possible that if Mark Wahlberg, instead of wearing a suit, had been wearing a Hawaiian shirt, which Sully should be?
Yeah, yeah.
Would it have been better?
That, and also he has to smoke a cigar.
Yeah.
He's got to look like he's a little bit full of himself, as well as a
bar. I bet that's in his contract. He's so health conscious. He wouldn't wear. He wouldn't smoke a cigar. Yeah.
Maybe he shouldn't throw acid in people's faces.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. So health conscious. Maybe just worry about other people's health.
That's his past. So yes, we're gonna give this a wait and see at best.
Yeah. The last trailer is a trailer that Dave and I didn't watch.
Right, but I've seen half of it.
But Dave's seen half of it,
and there's a specific reason which we'll discuss.
Oh, we're on the spectrum again. Nick's seen the whole trailer. You've seen half. I've seen none.
Fascinating. Yeah. This is it's rare that we get that particular brand of spectrum.
Literally
movie,
zero.
It's a horror movie.
Yes.
It's by Scott Derrickson and Robert Cargill.
Yeah.
The guys who wrote Sinister
and
Doctor Strange.
And what is this new one called?
It's called The Black Phone.
Black Phone.
Yeah. And the weird thing to me, by the way, when I first saw this trailer is it was when I was working on the Dread game for y'all, which begins with kids at a school worried about a prowler, which is also how this trailer opens. Pretty clear that Ethan Hawke is the creepy prowler man with a very scary mask.
Yeah, yes.
It's like a demon goblin mask.
Yeah, he abducts kids like with an ice cream truck kind of thing? Or is it
he was doing the thing where he kind of like... It was kind of like Silence of the Lambs, where he was like loading up something, and he was like, fell down, and he kind of seemed like he was playing it a little like he was a little mentally off or something. He's like, oh, what a knucklehead I am or something.
Yeah.
And this kid is like, I think tries to help him or whatever, and clearly gets taken by him.
Yep.
Lesson learned, kids. Don't help anyone.
Don't help.
And this is
maybe don't help the Goblin Mask Man. He didn't have the mask.
And this is based off of a Joe Hill book. Or short story, I think.
Which is pretty notable. And it does, like, get to a somewhat more fantastical element. It is not just some creepy kid abduction movie. There is that element, but there's something more that's happening.
Yeah, there's...
Because the kid is locked in a room.
Yep.
And there's a phone in there that
It's not hooked up to anything.
Doesn't the bad guy call him sometimes? I got the impression that he did.
No.
Or I guess you just see him kind of like howling and yelling at him and stuff.
He doesn't have any knowledge of the phone or something, but the people that call him every night at midnight are
the
kids who have been abducted and killed.
Right. It's pretty macabre, but it seems like it's potentially his lifeline.
Right.
And so I think it is going to be a high suspense-y kind of movie. The vibe I'm betting it'll be is a little like Split from Shyamalan, which is to say a fairly extended kid trapped and terrorized, but with sort of a weird supernatural lifeline, maybe.
Yeah.
Do the kids, when they call, is it like the Corey Haim lifeline? Do they just, they call and they're like, they start talking to him about their lives, and there's like,
no.
do you like NSYNC?
Actually, you know what? I think they're probably like, we've been trying to reach you about your extended warranty.
I can tell you what, because it is shown a little bit what they're calling about, but I don't want to spoil it for Dave.
Oh, okay. Right.
Oh, so I should say that now, the reason I only watched half of it, because I watched half of the trailer, and I was like, this looks really good. I feel they're starting to give more away than I wanted to know. I'm more or less sold because I liked Sinister.
I like Ethan Hawke.
I didn't quite love it, but I thought it was quite good. And I was like, I've seen enough that I want to watch this movie. And so I was already on board, and I just didn't want to have it spoiled.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think Sinister's the one I haven't seen. I watched Insidious.
It's dark.
I like, you know, it is
one of those ones that's a little more disturbing than most.
But it's also another one where Ethan Hawke and his acting pedigree brings a lot to the table because he can tell a story.
Yeah, it could have been almost a little pedestrian, but it's like pretty interesting at almost every turn.
Yeah.
I feel like people, it came out when they were making movies like Conjuring and Insidious and then Sinister, and I'm like, none of your movies does a very good job of telling me what this goddamn movie is.
Yep. I think I would say to steer clear of the sequel.
Yes, I've seen the sequel, and it is not particularly good. But Randy, knowing that you have enjoyed both Insidious and Conjuring, although it is not quite in that style, it's ballpark enough that I would suggest you see it.
I might do that at some point. Last bit of news is that Brendan Fraser has been cast as maybe Firefly in the Batgirl movie for HBO Max. So this is interesting. The movie is going to be... it stars Leslie Grace, who I don't know who that is. It's done by the Bad Boys for Life directors. And the script is from the screenwriter who wrote Birds of Prey, which I actually liked quite a bit.
Bad Boys for Life got pretty
it was good
responses.
I think it did.
I saw a surprising number of people liked it, given the Bad Boys pedigree.
Leslie Grace was in The Heights. She was one of the leads.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think we knew that, yeah.
Everybody who was in The Heights did a great job, so that means I probably automatically like her.
And then J.K. Simmons is returning as Jim Gordon. I assume the swole Jim Gordon from Justice League.
He's a little creepy, honestly.
He is.
He was, like too muscular.
I like J.K. Simmons, and I think he would make a good Gordon. I don't need him to be swole.
Yeah.
I blame Zack Snyder for that.
Yeah. It's Gotham...
You don't even see that he's swole. He's in, like, trench coat and everything.
His smoky trench coat
covering
up his...
Did he just do that? He's like, I'm doing a super movie. I'm going to get all ripped.
He's like, wait a minute. I'm not playing Batman?
Oh, this is awkward.
I think it would make more sense if it was Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah.
Maybe he's going to go get the photos of Spider-Man himself. He's like, I'll take down the wall crawler. You're going to get your ass beat by an old man.
Isn't that what they're doing? They're not going back to the Zack Snyder thing. It doesn't make sense.
I don't know. The DC doesn't have continuity, Nick.
Right.
I thought they were going Batman side.
They're not trying very hard, no.
Because they're doing what? The Batgirl movie and they're doing a Nightwing thing?
I don't know.
Is there any reason that couldn't line up with Snyder's thing?
Well, I think Selena Gray... She's Hispanic or black? I can't...
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's pretty different from what they've done.
I just thought it would... With Jeffrey Wright, you kind of had the continuity there.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who knows?
Anyway, weird. That's our news for the week. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about comics. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, October 26th. Spooky comics.
Oh, is it spooky comics?
Oh, that's a Halloween week, right?
Let's try and make sure that every description we have of a comic finds the spooky in it.
Yeah, it's a good idea. All right, well, it's easy. We'll start with House of Slaughter.
Yeah.
This
one's going to be easy.
This is Boom's spinoff of Something is Killing the Children. This is a prequel, I believe?
It is. It's a prequel to one of the characters that shows up in the first volume of... Something is Killing the Children.
Yes.
And it's by the writer of that?
It is by Tinian. James Tinian. Art by whatever Bromball, which I don't know if that's the regular artist. I don't think it is, right?
It is not.
Tate Bromball, but it's good art.
And I did not get around to reading this one yet, so you guys tell me the most important question that I have. So, do I need to have read Something is Killing the Children?
I don't think so. I've read the first volume of Something is Killing the Children, really liked it, don't remember a single thing that happens in it. I've been waiting for the hardcover to come out to go and read it. But this is basically about this, like, this mysterious House of Slaughter where they train monster hunters. And
who's they?
There's a group that's the White Masks and the Black Masks.
Okay.
And they seem there seems to be some inner school rivalries. And their lead character, named Aaron Slaughter. Yes.
Yeah.
Is trained to be a hunter, but his trainer is like, you're too emotional. And the other house is like they're more like the combat house, and they're so he's like has a rivalry going with these other hunters, and it's basically sort of like whether or not he's going to be too soft and is going to wind up getting killed, and then there's a big twist at the end. I really liked this. Just like with something that's called The Children, it's one of those things like, oh, it's kind of like Buffy, and then it's about monster hunters. But it's kind of nothing like Buffy in its, right. in its approach.
Right. And is there anything else that you can sense that it feels similar to?
Supernatural? A little bit more. A little bit more like a Supernatural, where it's like hunting monsters definitely is not a fun occupation to have.
Right, right.
Yeah.
In Supernatural, it does kind of look fun.
A little bit more of the world building that's not in something that's killing the children, because that's really all about Erica and
her out in the world. This is more about the organization that does this. Yeah,
and we're getting kind of a story about Aaron and about him at the beginning, and then him on like at his peak where he's on a mission.
Yeah,
and it's an interesting kind of look at this character who we've only seen in one volume, and he was interesting there too, but I like getting a bit more and his little ghost creature that he keeps.
Yeah, yeah.
The art is really good. It fits in line with what the Something Is Killing the Children, kind of that hard lined work.
It looks super good.
Yeah.
It reminds me, I mean, like on some level it looks a little bit like the art on, you know, some of Ed Brubaker's artists that he works with, but it's also a little bit different too. Yeah, it reminds me a bit of Marcos Martin, who we did work with him.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is also, I don't know if people have noticed that Something Is Killing the Children went from being kind of like a cult book to something that's going to get a TV show, and people are always asking us, do we have issue number one so they can go sell it for $1 million?
Which we don't.
And then there's the first volume of it, which is sometimes out of stock, I think, back now?
Right now we have one, two, and three, although two is about to go out of print again.
But I bring it up because everybody was seeking for those early issues because that became a super, super hit. So get in on the ground floor, you dum-dums.
Yeah. So My House of Slaughter number one, not only is a good book, you might be able to use it to send your kids to college.
So tangentially related, I do want to mention that there's a second volume of James Tynion's other book, Department of Truth, hitting this week.
Yeah,
it's Tynion week.
This is the sort of conspiracy theory-fueled... if you believe it enough, the world warps to that image.
Yeah, it bends reality.
Bends reality. It's been super good. The second volume, I think, does the first, or 8 through 13. Yeah. So, highly recommend this series.
Same. It's really good. And Tynion also has another spooky book this week. He has got...
All right, it is spooky as well.
Don't lose the theme.
Co-writing with Matthew Rosenberg and art by Otto Schmidt, who did some of the Green Arrow stuff.
Green Arrow.
This is DC versus Vampires, a 12-issue sort of alternate world take in which vampires have decided there's been a coup at the upper level of the vampire councils, and vampires decide that they are going to take over the world and exterminate humans. And they get a hold of some superheroes.
It's like James Tynion's taking a little bit out of the playbook of Tom Taylor.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I even read, like, a solicit for it that said something like, inspired by deceased.
Yeah.
So, like they're not particularly trying to hide that this is a little bit of a, hey, let's have some fun with DC horror riffs. This is one of those things that's like, is it outside continuity? Right? It's not the real DC universe is not, like, under assault from vampires right now.
Exactly. Yeah. It feels closer to the continuity that Deceased does.
Is that a Gorilla City gorilla?
Yeah, no, that is actually...
That's Grodd.
Oh, neat.
The first attack, without giving too much away, happens at the Legion of Doom.
Nice. That sounds like fun.
There were some fun twists and turns in here.
There are. And one of our lead characters is Andrew Bennett, Eye Vampire, which is kind of cool.
Nice.
It was fun. It's not Deceased level. Deceased is one of our favorite books.
Right.
But it's a solid opener.
Right. Sounds like worth checking out if that's kind of sounds like your thing.
Also, if you like zombies, DC has Task Force Z, number one.
Not Task Force X, but Task Force Z.
In which Red Hood has been...
also written by Matthew Rosenberg.
Yeah. And he's been dragged into a mission with this mysterious organization. Basically, they reanimate dead supervillains and do a Suicide Squad type thing with them. Although the villains are like... somewhat zombie-ish. They get a little peckish for human flesh.
And some of them can talk.
So basically, they've got Bane and Man-Bat and...
I was under the impression that they had gone through Arkham Knight.
Yeah, their version of the Arkham Knight.
Specifically these were dead Arkham
And Bloom, inmates. The character from Scott Snyder's...
That's a deep and strange cut, because I was never quite sure what Bloom's deal was. He was some kind of evil flower man.
But it's interesting. It's more action-heavy.
Yep. I will also mention the art in it is fantastic. It's Eddie Barrows.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's always good.
Also spooky, Batman the Long Halloween gets a special.
Yeah, this is something like 25 years in the making, yeah. I think.
It's Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, neither of whom work at a super fast pace.
Nope. But they did become iconic as a team together and wrote one of the best-known Batman graphic novels now of all time, The Long Halloween, as well as the follow-up Dark Victory. Prior to that, they'd been working on like these shorter Halloween specials for DC.
You might remember correctly, it was a trilogy, right? And then there was Haunted Night.
Haunted Night was a series of one shots that came beforehand.
Ah, okay.
And this is kind of
in that vein, but it does reference some key characters from Long Halloween, like Calendar Man.
Yeah, this is in some ways an epilogue between it's a space between Long Halloween and Dark Victory.
Yeah,
but also yeah, it is a standalone because it's about Calendar Man versus Two-Face and. There's a Robin subplot. There's a lot of the stuff. If you like these guys' stuff that they've worked together on, everything from this to like Spider-Man Blue and all that, this feels like what they do, which is a little bit of nostalgia plus some new twists and really, really beautiful art.
The I think when I was looking at the solicit of it, it said something like, Loeb and Sale begin a new tradition of DC Halloween specials.
Yep.
So I get the feeling they may do like another trilogy of them or something.
Well, it
like
does
that.
Say the end for now.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see.
The end until next Halloween, if their schedules allow it.
All right. I'm not sure how spooky this one is. Green Arrow, Aquaman, Deep Target. How is that spooky?
The trench from Aquaman takes place underwater. So, True. You know, that could be spooky.
Yep.
But this is an 80th anniversary thing I saw. They're both hitting 80 years, and it teams up. It's kind of an unlikely pairing, right? It's the Archer Man and the Swimmy Man.
Yeah. This is a weird one, because midway through, we see that an underwater-equipped Green Arrow is going, and Oliver Queen has, like, taken over the throne of Atlantis somehow, and Aquaman is in the bow. It's very strange.
Let me just ask, had he actually taken over, or was he, like, did he just kind of walk into the throne room and he was just doing it to, like, shine him on?
I don't know, and he's got his powers.
By the way, let me tell you, if I do go to Atlantis, I will sit on the throne if they don't stop me.
It looks like they may have been body swapped or something, and there's a bad guy who's like bringing dinosaurs into our time with time travel.
Randy, do you remember when who's the guy who wrote Back to the Future who wrote some weird comics?
Bob Gale.
Yes. Bob Gale. Yeah. Bob Gale wrote some spectacularly weird comics, especially if you ever see the Ant-Man Christmas or holiday special or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds a little bit like a Bob Gale story.
It does. It's
which
a little
is
weird.
To say I might be sort of recommending it on the basis of the weirdness.
Yeah, if you like weirdness, yeah.
Or this may give you a tale to tell.
But neither Green Arrow nor Aquaman have their own book right now, so it makes sense they give them a team up.
Yep.
Aftershock is a new book called Cross the Bear, which is takes place in 1880s Boston.
Spooky 1880s.
Spooky 1880s, yes. And it seems to be mixing Western genre... with, like, Knights Templar stuff.
Okay.
So that's another one from them. There's nothing scarier than killer robots.
I guess. Yeah, I've seen scary killer robots.
So there's a War of Bounty Hunters one-shot featuring IG-88.
I don't know why, but they made 800 covers for it, and I like all of them.
They're all good.
They are all good.
A second printing of Me, You Love in the Dark... the sort of a spooky ghost story image book that we all really liked.
Yeah.
Or at least you and I really liked. I don't know if Nick's read it.
I have not.
Yeah, somewhere between being kind of sweet and being kind of weird and disturbing.
Yeah.
Which I really like that line that they walk there because I wasn't... I, 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 It's been a book that I haven't been able to predict where it is going, and it's been fascinating to read. Artwork.
I've been really enjoying it, and it's issue one is back in stock now, so we have issues 1, 2, and 3.
And I honestly feel like was it Jorge Corona that like he should be an Eisner Award candidacy for his work on that.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's really good. Dave, you have The Walking Cat.
The Walking Cat. It's not The Walking Dead. It's The Walking Cat. But they are riffing on The Walking Dead because this is a cat in a zombie apocalypse.
Making it spooky.
It's for sure. The subtitle of it is A Cat's Eye View of the Zombie Apocalypse. The cover shows a sort of bloodied survivor holding what looks like a very content cat, just kind of curled up in his arms. And that is what it is about. I read that this is, in fact, what had been a 3-volume series now collected in a big omnibus. And from what I can tell, it's very well done. It's super great artwork. But literally a guy who is a survivor in a zombie apocalypse. Early on, he sees a cat chasing a rat through, like, a field, and a zombie grabs the rat as it's going by and eats it.
Okay.
And then the zombies see the cat, and they all start racing after it, and he vaults out and, like, scoops up the cat and runs off with it, and the cat starts hanging with him. Okay. They're rolling. And what follows is, it seems like a series of sort of short stories about their life. The cat, is some story about survival that has something to do with the cat, and it is alternately very cute, but it is like, it does treat the zombies seriously, but like, I will give you an example of like, sort of one of the weird things that happened. At one point, they're traveling around, and the cat goes like, into heat.
Okay.
And sees another cat nearby, and there's some hilarious art that's just like, really spectacularly captures the weirdness of cats with their eyes all bugging out, wanting to get it on. And as the cats are like sort of circling and fighting with each other at first, some zombies start to approach, and he goes running up with his knife to stab him in the head, and he's like, don't you dare interrupt him, or whatever. So he's like fighting off the zombies so the cats can do their thing.
Oh, okay.
There's like more serious stuff in it too, but I honestly feel like, although it is kind of a novelty concept, it takes itself very seriously, and the art and stuff is so good and it's so well done. I read several of the short stories in it that I'm going to go ahead and recommend it to cat people in general, or anybody who's liked any of the various cat comics that manga has produced over the years. This artist knows how to capture a cat visually. So, yes, The Walking Cat. Give it a shot.
That may be all the spooky comics for the week.
Yeah.
But I also want to mention that Daredevil has its penultimate issue before they go into Devil's Reign. It's been really good.
What's a Devil's Reign?
That's Kingpin takes over New York City kind of thing.
Is it still going to be that writer?
It is going to be Chip Zdarsky, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Moon Knight has a 4th issue featuring Tigra.
Yep. Tigra.
Tigra.
Yep.
Is it Tigra?
It is Tigra. Okay, all right. I think we decided that.
I couldn't remember which one I mispronounced, but I knew that I was yep. wrong. Which I like the initiative, and they reference their past as West Coast Avengers, or Wackos, as they call it.
I don't like that.
I like that a lot.
But I like referencing it. I don't like calling them Wackos.
I like that a lot. That was the thing they did. They did that in the West Coast Avengers book.
Oh, I didn't read much past the original miniseries, and it was not done in that.
Yeah.
It was also a good spotlight on Mark.
Yeah.
I thought it was good character development.
Yeah. And they're... McKay is doing heroic work here trying to reconcile all the various takes on Moon Knight.
Yeah.
Like, he references the stuff that Bendis did. He references the stuff that Charlie Houston did. There's a bit here where he's talking to, like, his psychiatrist and saying something like, I actually at one point was, like, tearing my opponent's faces off, and I don't know what I was doing. I don't know what that was about.
Oh, wow, they mentioned, that was like the early 2000s, right?
Yeah.
When they were like making it hard.
Carving crescent moons on people's faces.
That was like the Zack Snyder Moon Knight. Yes.
And the Jason Aaron where he like took over the world for a moon for a moon god.
Yeah, he references all of that, and he's like, yeah, this, I don't know why I did any of that.
Jed McKay was the guy who was doing Black Cat, right?
Yep.
Yes.
So I remember, like, I just read random issues of that, but there was one I really liked where she had a date with, who was it? Who was the villain?
Batroc.
Batroc, yeah.
Batroc Sleeper.
And he was taken halfway seriously, more than halfway seriously,
yep.
And it was a really kind of sweet issue. So I could see how he could take a character like Tigra, who is often like a C-list character. Mm-hmm. Nobody, very, very rarely does somebody kind of know what they want to do with her or manage to accomplish like a notable story. So that's cool. I like seeing him. I suspect he's doing it again.
Taking a character that. They bring her in, and she's dealing. He's talking to his appointed therapist, and he's wearing his Mr. Knight costume. And she comes in, and she's like, Mike, Mark, why are you making this poor child call you that? Is this your new thing, mask and suit? And starts pulling off his mask.
Oh wow!
And yeah, there's some fun stuff in there. And then at the end, she has a sort of sweet moment where she's like, stop BSing me. I can tell me what's going on. I can tell something's wrong. And it's like that. Yeah. An old friend comes into town and gets you to talk and. It's good.
That's cool.
I thought it was a really good use of both characters.
Neat.
I also really like McNiven's cover. I don't know why. It just looks like a cool version of those characters.
Well, we were talking about this earlier. Tigra was kind of drawn as like a furry, pretty lady in a bikini.
Yeah.
And it actually looks cooler to give her like kind of the... Well, she's got like jeans and a shredded t-shirt, right, this one. And it's kind of a cooler new look for her, and he did a good job with it.
Yeah.
And then Amazing Spider-Man has their third issue of the current run, number 77, which has Ben training with the Daughters of the Dragon.
And this is also the first one of the rotating writers and artists. Yeah. This is Kelly Thompson and Sarah Pacelli.
Sarah Pacelli on art, which is great.
The art is gorgeous.
Yeah. And they're delving more into him being run by the Beyond Corporation and what that means for a corporate superhero. And then Morbius shows up and is scary.
It also brings in the more of the Daughters of the Dragon.
It does.
Which is pretty cool.
Well, McKay wrote that Daughters of the Dragon thing, and I think he's going to be touching that again, too. So, and then Robin number 7, which continues the death tournament and has some big reveals about Lazarus Island and the woman who runs it, which I thought was kind of cool.
Nice.
I'm digging this book, the Robin book. I like what they're doing with Damian.
I forgot to. I might be like one or two behind on that one, and at this point, I think I might well pick up one of the trade paperback when that hits. So he's done a good job.
There is also the big mega edition of Paper Girls, a complete saga in one trade.
Funny you should say saga.
And it's $50, by the way. Not bad for the entire Paper Girls.
I will also say it has flaps.
It has flaps, and therefore it's fancy.
In the event that you are not familiar with Paper Girls, it's from Brian Vaughn, a.k.a. the dude who wrote Why Last Man when it was a good comic and not a bad canceled show.
Also, the gorgeous, wonderful art of Cliff Chang, who now has the
Catwoman Lonely City, which we talked about last week, which is really good.
I didn't get a chance to talk about it. It is one of my favorite reads from this month.
It was really good, right?
I don't know how... I mean... Chang's worked with a lot of great writers, and I think he learned a lot from them, and it was fantastic.
Somebody read it, one of our customers, and said that it's like this is basically Catwoman's Dark Knight Returns story.
That could often be a bad thing. Somebody like, I'm doing my Dark Knight, and you're like, whatever. Good.
Well, it felt like Cliff Chang learned, I don't know, has he ever worked with Brubaker? Because it felt like a Brubaker book.
I think he has, but I'm not positive.
Because it felt like a Brubaker.
Yeah, I can see
when
that.
When Brubaker was writing Catwoman.
Yeah.
Well, if nothing else, he may have studied those closely, picked up some stuff, and brought his own newness to the table.
The only thing I was missing is I wanted Slam Bradley in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Or some reference to
it. The reason I was mentioning, just to conclude the thought, was also Brian Vaughn did Saga, one of the best-selling comics that we've had, one that's returning.
Yep.
Paper Girls was his project... along the side of that,
about midway through.
Yeah, and we've sometimes compared it to Stranger Things. It's set in the 80s. Followed a group, or at least initially.
Yep.
Followed a group of girls who were literal kind of paper girls.
It's got some weird time travel
ragtag
stuff.
Group of like a number of different character types. And I have not read it all, but it's been another success, and so that's cool to see it all in one nice big trade.
And it's coming to Amazon Prime next year, I think.
Yep.
So this is their get it all while you can.
Yep.
Hopefully, we'll fare better than Why Last Man.
Yes, hopefully, adaptation a little bit better.
Well, those like Invincible when that took off, those big omnibus volumes just started selling on the hourly basis or something like that.
Sure.
So this is once again a chance to get in on if not the ground floor. This is a series that began some years ago, but to before it becomes a TV show and to tell all your friends how cool you are.
Well, and it's one and done. This is all of it, which is really cool.
Nick, did I miss anything?
There is a one-shot, The Darkhold Blade.
Spooky. Also spooky.
Also very spooky. It's I think the second one shot they've done of the Darkhold stuff after Iron Man
one last week,
which was loosely a Scarlet Witch gathering people to stop Doom from getting in.
That was the one shot.
Oh, I thought that was all of them.
No, these are sort of like glimpses as into these characters as they look into. Is it not the Necronomicon? It's the Darkhold.
Yeah.
As they've glimpsed into Darkhold and like what they see their lives becoming, it's very twisted and dark, and usually doesn't end well.
I guess that
it's like spooky. What if?
Yeah. I guess it is the Darkhold.
Yes.
I want to look in the Darkhold.
No, you do not want to look into Chthon's brain.
And who is Darkhold?
Don't look into Chthon's Darkhold. all right, I think is that all of the stuff?
Comics and stuff, yeah. I think we're going to move on to topics in a minute and we got to talk about Dune.
That's right, we're going to talk about Dune. So come back and hear us talk about and probably spoil Dune. All right, return with us to the desert planet of Arrakis.
It's hot. There's spices. Sandworms,
spices.
Yep.
You have to do that dance if you want to survive.
You're talking about the dance walk?
Yes.
Yeah.
So let's...
By the way, that was a good way of showing that. It's tough to show people walking without rhythm without just showing an average white guy. it's tough to show that quite and capture it without just looking like a doofus.
Yeah. So let's... We're going to put a spoiler warning up. If you've not watched Dune yet, you can watch it. It's in theaters. Some people say if you don't watch it in theaters, why are you even watching it?
I know a number of people who've watched it at home and have enjoyed themselves.
You can also watch it on HBO Max, which is how I watched it, and quite enjoyed myself.
This being the third incarnation of Dune on film. And by the way,
there was a miniseries, right?
There was a sci-fi miniseries that even also adapted, took the next two books and kind of put them into one miniseries.
Okay.
Had William Hurt.
That did. He is a perfect boring actor for Leto Atreides.
So, I have never seen the first movie. I've never seen the miniseries. I forgot it existed. And I've never read the books. Mm-hmm. So I was not sure I was going to watch this. Mm-hmm. And I was hearing some sort of mixed reviews. But Dave, I know you've been reading the books.
Yeah.
And you had a fanatic who dragged you to the theater.
Yes, that's right. I have a sort of, in short, mixed feelings on the books, but find them interesting. And I ended up with mixed feelings on the movie, but found it interesting. Over the last year or two, I've read two and a half of the books, I guess.
Okay.
I'm on what would be the third one.
How many books are there? Five?
Herbert wrote six.
Okay. All right.
Are they like the Grant, like super long, like the Tolkien?
Not really. They're long enough. You know, I think you're looking at 400, 500 pages at least. I think that. Yeah, I think they're not crazy long. And then they did get taken over as a franchise by, I think his son, something, Steve Herbert, whatever, Brian Herbert.
Yeah.
And Kevin J. Anderson, who also did Star Wars books.
Right. Nick, what about you? What was your experience with Dune?
I watched the David Lynch movie. Okay. I have not seen the miniseries, even though I may have watched snippets of it. Never read the books.
Okay. The miniseries is like... I watched the first one recently, and it's solid. Like it's actually pretty good, especially if you are a reader of the books. You're going to see stuff that doesn't generally make it into most cuts of it, and they also it's not without its pretty good design work and stuff like that. I gather it was like the biggest sci-fi movie, or maybe even still is their biggest, highest rated sci-fi movie.
It was definitely before Battlestar and all that other stuff,
right? Yeah, and you know, it kind of can't help but look a little cheap.
Yeah.
But overall, by the way, I think I would say I prefer Lynch's kind of weird one, with its kind of... nobody can say it's a masterpiece. Well, I'm sure someone did. But, but it is a sort of a very watchably weird botched effort, I think.
Yeah.
I like that a little over the new one, but I did find a lot to like in it. And Nick, where did you land on the new one?
I liked it and enjoyed it with some a few qualms.
Oh, interesting.
I was expecting to turn it off half an hour in, to be honest. I was like, this is not going to be for me.
Do you like Denis Villeneuve?
I am extremely hit or miss.
Okay.
His big ones were Arrival and Blade Runner 2049.
I liked Arrival. I quite liked Blade Runner 2049. And I feel like there was something else he did. Did he do Annihilation? Was that him too?
No. I looked it up because I thought it was him, but it's not.
That Emily Blunt, Sicario.
Sicario. I did not like Sicario.
And didn't he do...
And I heard Sicario was good, but I have not seen
it. It's good. It's super dark.
I just didn't like Sicario.
But he also did...
That was not like a... That was a rare non-sci-fi thing.
The Prisoner... Not Prisoner. It was the Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah. So I'm not like a fanatic for him or anything, but I was like, he can make good movies, but sometimes his movies are a little dry. And with Dune also being dry, I was like, this is not going to be for me. Instead,
Prisoners.
I thought he did a great job of, like, explaining the premise, explaining the characters. Like, I was like, oh, okay, I know what's going on. This is interesting. I like that they're tackling these sort of imperialist narrative in a different way. Mm-hmm. That basically that House Atreides are, like, supposed to be the good guys, but they're still a big noble house. And so when they come in, it's like, oh, they are still, like, oppressors, basically.
Right. They are looking, for people who don't know, in a kind of feudal future where, like, computers have been kind of outlawed thousands of years ago. They don't make much of it in the movie, but essentially you have kind of human computers called Mentats. There's very little exposition, so they don't really mention that very much, if at all. But you have, like, a galaxy-wide kind of, feudal kingdom with different fiefdoms and stuff like that, fighting it out, great houses, just like Game of Thrones and stuff.
I was going to say, I don't think this works as well as it does without the existence of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, you can buy into it a lot easier. Yeah.
It primed people for it. Yeah. But yeah, it's a weird thing to like quite see this far-flung a future, but still like, you have dukes and stuff like that. But anyway, the evil Harkonnen sort of generally think Lannisters, I guess.
Yeah.
They've been running the planet Arrakis, where everybody needs the spice that's on it because it allows the people who do hyperspace travel to do it.
They did a very good job. I don't remember if it was it a voiceover or was it actually a crawl.
I think Paul was beginning. Like studying and he was like had like learning videos running.
Because at the very beginning they explained, they're like, this is desert, this is Arrakis. The spice is what gives the natives their sort of like blue eyes and like psychic powers a little bit or something.
Yeah, they have like low level prescience.
It is also like it's sacred to them. But if we take it, it is the only way intergalactic travel is possible.
Yeah.
So it's like basically the world economy relies on the substance that is in control of these like of this like native population.
Yeah.
And I can't think of any anything in the real world that's like that. So I can't see where any of the relevance comes.
Frank Herbert saw it way back in the 60s.
Yeah.
I think it is a narcotic as well. Yeah, like that's a... And it's just blown around in the desert. You can just go out there and trip balls.
Yeah, go out in the desert and trip balls. People do that all the time.
But yes, the sort of more noble family Atreides, think the Starks.
Yeah.
They are given control of this. And it's... I don't know. I can't quite remember how well, because I've seen so many different versions and read the books, how well this is explained in the movie. But the Emperor, he wanted them out of the way. He knew that he kind of aided and abetted the Harkonnens in, like... in retaliation and stuff.
And we never see the Emperor at all.
No. You do in most versions. He's like straight up a character. I suspect you'll see him in the second one.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm quite sure you will see him. So he wants to remove a potential rival, the Atreides family. And so he sets him up in charge of this very important thing and sets him up to fail. And that's also, that's the whole premise basically there in a nutshell.
But also there's this, the sister, the Bene Gesserit.
Yep, they sort of, they sometimes will call them, like, witches, but think, Jedi Knights a little bit if you want. They're a, like, manipulative sisterhood that has sort of a hidden power running through the whole galaxy.
But they're also, like, there's this whole Chosen One narrative that they've been building, so they're, like, this religious force. So there's, like, there's religious and politics and, like, sci-fi, and then you have the Fremen, which are sort of the natives...
There's a bigger chunk about, like, economics and stuff in the book. Not that they do super deep dives, but there's, essentially a mega corporation called CHOM, which is an acronym for something like that, that they also, like, they are kind of constantly trying to balance the great houses versus the Emperor versus CHOM.
Okay.
And everybody has to kind of find some way to sort of please everybody. And there's also, like, the Spacing Guild, the guys who kind of run the hyperspace stuff.
Yeah.
But... A little bit more of that is made in the book, but yeah, it's essentially a kind of complex scenario where it's not easy to get out of a trap laid by somebody like the Emperor.
Right. Well, it's interesting because watching this, I found it very compelling, but in describing it, it sounds like sitting there having someone tell you about his D&D game.
Yeah,
like,
right.
It really doesn't sound like it should be good. But I think Villeneuve did a great job, and I think...
He did the exposition better than probably anybody else I've seen, which is to say, at no point does somebody just start telling you facts.
Right.
It kind of comes out in conversations,
yep.
Sometimes mimicking actual ways it was done in the book, but there was a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. And by the way, we haven't mentioned Paul yet. We should mention he is the chosen one of the narrative you mentioned.
Yeah, he's the young heir to the Atreides house.
Yep.
His mother is a worshiper of the Bene Gesserit, has some of the like psychic powers, and she's training him in it against their wishes. And his father is Oscar Isaac plays Duke Leto.
His mom is like fully a member of the Bene Gesserit.
She is.
And
Correct.
Yeah,
I believe the deal that they sort of explain more clearly in the book is she and the Duke really did always love each other, but he couldn't take her as a wife because he had to always potentially be available for political reasons.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I might marry somebody's family daughter and unite a family at any given time.
Yeah.
Honestly, I thought Rebecca Ferguson did one of the best jobs
the
movie.
The cast of this was really good. The guy they got, Timothy Chalamet playing playing Paul, I think is really good.
He's a good one. Like, he's kind of a little bit angsty and emo, but he kind of pulls it off. He pulls it off in a way that doesn't feel trite. I'll give him that.
Stellan Skarsgård plays a really good Baron Harkonnen. Mm-hmm. We don't see a lot of him, but Dave Bautista as... The Beast Sabacc, is that
Beast
his name?
Raban.
Beast Raban.
Yeah, like, he actually has, like, a real name. Beast is effectively a nickname, but yeah. There's a, I found him distracting.
Really?
Literally, his visual is so, in sci-fi stuff, is so Drax associated with me, that it was a little tough for me to see him and not see Drax. And I was thinking, like, he's played big bruisers in, like, other movies, but in the Bond movie, he looked a little different.
Well, he played kind of an off-type in Blade Runner 2049.
Right, he had the glasses and stuff on in there. I was just thinking, like, oh, every time I see him effectively bald, am I just going to think, oh, it's Drax? And, like, no, he can pull me in other directions, but he just looked a little too visually close, even though he's not character close to
him. The other meathead they've got is Jason Momoa.
Right, playing the very likable...
Duncan Idaho.
Yeah.
There was a great meme going around about that. There's a desert world, it's full of these drugs that also fuel space travel. Okay, yes, there are giant sandworms who, if you don't dance properly, they will find you and swallow you. Okay, sure, there's a guy named Duncan Idaho. Wait, what? Yeah. And it is like everything else is so weird and far-flung, and his name is very weird, but... Great character.
Yeah.
He's like one of the soldiers, but also a diplomat. He sort of goes native with the Fremen.
Yep.
And then he's like a mentor and a father figure to Paul.
Yep.
Yeah.
One of my complaints about any given version of this is that with Paul as the central character, a part of it is that even though it doesn't sort of ultimately prove to be as you read other books, it does feel like a white savior narrative.
Yeah.
It like kind of just can't help but look like that.
Yeah.
Atreides is even a very Euro-Greek name.
Yeah.
And... and I'm like, I kind of can't help but feel that like Paul is this very privileged savior figure, not an everyman like you often get in these prophecy type movies, because he's got like three, you know, like guys who are all sort of devoted to training him, and they're like, I'll die for you,
and
my young prince.
They're all the best people. Like Duncan Idaho is the best warrior who also can go native of the Fremen, and Josh Brolin. Josh Brolin. Who did he play?
He's
Gurney Halleck.
Gurney Halleck. Yeah,
he's like the weapons master, and he's a master warrior. And the Harkonnens even talk about like, yeah, with those two guys, they're the best fighters in the universe.
Yeah.
And then his dad is like this ultra noble Stark type dude.
Right.
And so yeah, it is like, and he is surrounded by like the best of the best.
Yeah. But Randy, I do want to make I think you made a good point earlier, which is about the fact that the Atreides. This is maybe even a little bit more obvious in the book to some degree, but they are there for their own personal gain too, right?
Yeah.
They've been manipulated into it, but they're going to try and make the best they can. And it's just that Duke Leto is not a guy who is going to exploit the Fremen.
No, they go out of there. I thought the way they did that in the movie was very clever. They show that he talks to Javier Bardem's character as leader of the Fremen,
mm-hmm.
and he presents himself as a more like honorable person.
Yep.
And then they did a bit, which I think was very clever, where there's like a crawler that's going out like harvesting spice, and a sandworm approaches, and they have this whole thing where they're like, they come in, a ship lifts it off the ground so the worm won't get it, and it fails. And Duke Leto, who's watching it, is like, no, we're evacuating those 21 men.
They use the iconic ornithopters, super coolly really visualized cool. in the movie.
But there's a line where he says, damn the spice, we're getting all 21 men off that thing. And it's the notion of this leader who will sacrifice like millions of space dollars.
Right, that's a fair way to put it.
21 people. I was like, okay, that's a clever way to show that this guy, for all that he is an imperialist, is a good person.
Right.
And so we'll feel bad when he is inevitably murdered.
By the way, that scene is very almost beat for beat from the book.
Interesting.
There's a spice harvester that gets destroyed by a sandworm. It's a good way to see how impressive they are early on. And I thought he did a really good job with the effects team and stuff like that, with visualizing it, where there's these reverberations before this worm's surface, mm-hmm. where the sand almost becomes water because it's shaking so hard. And I'd seen lots of different versions of the sandworms as well over the years, and never quite that effect. And although I prefer the look of the sandworms in Lynch's ones, with the kind of triple sort of mouth, I guess, in it, the way that they move and surface and stuff like that is coolest in this one.
It is. I thought that was good. The ornithopters look really cool.
There's a lot of neat ideas, like the thumper, too, the thing that you'll put into sometimes to call the worms or distract them, which, because rhythmic things draw them and they just destroy it, so you walk over the land and they'll kill you.
Yep.
But if you walk kind of without rhythm, that they will not notice you. They'll take it to be just desert stuff.
Yeah. And visually, Villeneuve knows his stuff.
Yeah.
I think the world is really interesting looking in its sort of desolation and but kind of this weird technology. I thought the buildings with that sort of like pyramid kind of look were interesting to look at.
Yeah.
You know what? What's a little weird to me, the sci-fi movie did this, is that the books are actually, like, if you just read how the people are described, it's quite a bit more colorful than most of the movies tend to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of brown
like
and gray.
There's like medieval pageantry, you know, it's like the Harkonnens will be flying these crimson and green flags or something like that, and it sounds more like, you know, on Game of Thrones when you hear like the houses described and see their banners and stuff like that. It's a little bit more like that in the books. That said, it is a very strong visual look.
Yeah.
Also, I really like the way they did their shields, where it's like
they have shields that for individual people.
Yeah, and they use this technology everywhere, but it's like all of them seem to have it. And like when Duncan is fighting the Emperor's guards, the Emperor's blades
Sardaukar Sardaukar. Like his like sort of elite troops.
There's a bit where he like is fighting a dozen guys, and it's like the blades go off the thing, but when you get someone, it turns red because it means you're like the blade is going slowly enough.
Right.
And it's a great visual effect. So you can tell what's going on.
Right. They literally, like, the energy field of the blade, it's not like, at first on the trailers when I was seeing that, I was like, oh, is that actual blood? But it's a little bit more like the energy field goes red to indicate dangerous penetration, essentially, of something. You know what I'm talking about. And so there's some stuff where, like, Duncan Idaho cuts loose on these dudes, and you just start see flashes of red everywhere from their suits because he knows how to use the blades.
Yep.
Did the movie make clear that it is, like, the slow use,
it
like
did,
you can't...
In Paul's training sequence with Thanos.
Okay, yeah. If you just drive down a blade real hard, it's just going to deflect off of this. But if you kind of do a slow stab, if you get in close and do it, then you can kill someone. And so it kind of, it fits the feudal idea that, like, that dueling can still have meaning in this world.
Yeah.
And it really is the MCU moved over into the world.
It's going to happen.
So many things are going to be.
So many people have been in the, between the MCU and the DC universe, everyone here has played a superhero.
And I think part of that was distracting to me.
Really?
It was only Drax, I guess.
And, well, I didn't think Josh Brolin was particularly great.
I thought he was underused.
Yeah.
By the way, I also thought underused.
That was one of my gripes, is everyone was underused.
I mean, it's a 2.5-hour movie. There's only so much you can do.
You could have done a little bit more. It could have been a little bit longer.
No, should not have been any longer.
He made choices when I saw this, we talked about it afterwards, and there's, like, I guess so much detail kind of packed into the book.
Yeah.
That there was, like Thufir Hawat, that's the Mentat guy. Who's the actor who played him?
I don't remember him.
He's great. He's been in a ton of stuff.
He's a guy. You've seen him.
Super good character actor. And they did a neat effect to show when he does calculations.
Yeah.
It's like his eyes just roll back into his head and white out. And then he's just like, he'll just be like, say some calculation, yeah, like he just computered it.
Yeah.
And there's so much more with him. He actually specifically dislikes the Bene Gesserit in the books. Like, he'll call them witches and stuff like that. And there's a bigger scheme that the actual attack on the House Atreides is not just like, oh, they just attack one day.
Yeah.
They infiltrate. They do have the Dr. Yui, who's the traitor. But more is made about like how they should not have been able to get past his conditioning. Yep. You know, they shouldn't have been able to turn him traitor. That they had put suspicions on Lady Jessica in the thing, and he was like quick to jump on it because I guess the idea is like as a sort of planner and a kind of living computer, these mysterious kind of supernatural women are something that disturbs him.
Yeah.
And so there's, I kind of missed some of that subplotty stuff, but I do think as far as like painting the bold spectrum stuff that he did it pretty ingeniously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's been called unadaptable. Like it's one of these things like, and I think some people gripe that basically this, you know, this movie doesn't have an ending, and it is, it's like Lord of the Rings. It's the first one that's like, oh, well, here, let's go hunt some orcs. That's not how this ends. They don't go hunt some orcs.
Well, I think I was more annoyed that it didn't have an ending, but there wasn't even the... they hadn't even greenlit the second one. Because if mean, it had...
It's a leap of faith. I think you have to do that. I think you can't try to end your movie if you know there's no satisfying ending.
I think they knew it was going to happen.
I think he was pretty confident.
I think he had made some videos, and today, literally, they greenlit it.
I know.
History will vindicate him, Nick.
But he finished this, like, what, a year ago?
Probably, something like that.
And, like, it's one of those things that if it didn't, it would have been...
It would have been, but here's the thing. There's no way it would have been successful if he tried to wrap it up, it also would not have worked. Because there's no way to tell the story in a way that ends.
The one thing that surprised me is that it does end a little bit like there's not a huge dramatic thing like the Balrog before it ends. There is a dramatic thing that happens, but it's not that big. There's like Duel.
Yeah, it's basically Paul coming into his own,
Also, part of me wonders if they shouldn't have ended like with the... kind of like Game of Thrones did in the first season, where it ends with, like, the attack, everybody dies, and then Paul and his mother wind up in the desert, and that would have been a good cliffhanger. If you want to go full-on cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But I think...
That's like the first fourth of the book, and that'd be a weird dividing point.
I think that's why.
Yeah. It's also annoying that just characters that you cared about just died instantly.
Like, yeah, I mean, it did happen.
It's like, no, I know. Yeah. It was just one of those things that felt a little wasteful.
Like who?
Like Duncan Idaho. I think you could have expanded a little bit with him.
But Duncan gets such a cool death.
He does get a good death.
He does.
But I mean, the Fremen lady who was about to, like, ride on the sandworm.
Right.
She was a great character.
Yeah.
It felt basically...
That was actually one of my favorite scenes, though. Her ending, which was not in the book. Mm-hmm. She was a guy in the book. That's Liet Kynes, the planetary kind of climatologist.
Yeah.
Who was, like, also a Fremen. In the book, dies of something else, but dies essentially of exposure in the desert. But got a cooler ending here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that was a really
cool
ending.
Super cool ending.
Yep.
It's just like everyone was dying.
That's how I'm going to go.
Was dying for Paul. And I was like, ugh.
That is kind of the nature of Dune.
It is a little bit like that, yeah.
It just felt a little kind of like, we've seen this kind of thing before.
I don't usually like Chosen One narratives.
No, me neither.
Honestly, The Matrix is a kind of a rare exception, but mostly I don't like it when there's some prophecy that someone will rise up. About the best you can do is just have it be kind of like, oh, it's a street rat or whatever, it turns out. And it's like, oh, it turns out the privileged son of a noble is is going to be the savior. That said, I was pretty happy with it. I'm even thinking I'm going to see it again to wrap my head more around it.
Well, I'm planning to see it in the theater this week, so.
You know what's weird is it's a little, this sounds like damning with faint praise, but it's a little like Watchmen in the sense to me, like Zack Snyder's Watchmen, that it caught all the major events. I felt like it lost a lot of context, but I was fascinated to still revisit Watchmen on the basis of just seeing it visualized. I think this is a better movie than Watchmen, probably. But there is something of that same. I just want to see it again to just see Dune visualized again.
Yeah, I get that. Well, that is probably about wraps it up for us this week. Enjoy your spooky Halloween, And until next time,
ride the sandworm.
Ride the sandworm. And until next time,
Yo-cho.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.